Welcome to session number 225 on same-gender marriage and religious freedom, a call to quiet conversation and public debate. Please turn off your cell phones. You may not know that there's a little trap door under each of your seats, and if that cell phone goes off, we reluctantly will have to flip open that trap door, and there's a den of hungry lions just anxious to meet you down below. I'm really excited to be chairing this session. Mary Ellen asked me if I would be willing to chair a couple of sessions. And she says, look at the program and look at four or five alternatives and pick one or two that you like, you know, two maybe that you like. I picked five and she assigned me to three. But the first one I checked off was, and I said, Dr. Gaddy is coming to Sunstone. That's fantastic. I've heard him on, I've watched him on Jim Lehrer NewsHour, Rachel Maddow, Keith Olbermann, and all sorts of other media where he's been a guest. And so I'm just really excited to. In fact, Francis Menlove there was crediting me with getting Dr. Gaddy here. I was very tempted to take credit, but I looked deep into my soul and I realized I would be compromising my rich reputation for humility, which I don't want to give up. A couple more things I want to say. He leads the National Interfaith Alliance. I sent him a check just last week. He was co-founded by Walter Cronkite to try to bring civil discourse into our society. He serves as the pastor for preaching and worship at Northminster Baptist Church in Monroe, Louisiana. He is a host of State of Belief, a national radio program founded in 1994. Interfaith Alliance is dedicated to promoting mutual respect, cooperation, and civility, and strives to promote religion as a positive and healing force in the life of the nation. He is one of 20 international religious leaders in the Council of 100 Leaders, a group created by the World Economic Forum to improve dialogue and understanding between the Western and Islamic worlds. And I'll just bet you this Council of 50 is twice a valuable force for peace in the world as Joseph Smith's Council of 50. So, have you here, Dr. Gaddy.
Thank you very much, Bill, and I'm delighted to be here with you today. Bill just was, you don't know that, but that was a trial interview for him joining our public relations staff. I did warn him, however, that a person who values humility would be out of place in our national offices in Washington. We have no idea how to spell humility in Washington. But it's a pleasure to be with you. I know of the work of this organization, and I'm delighted to be a part of that work and so grateful for the invitation. I think we have a lot to talk about. I want to lay a foundation for a conversation that we can have together today, if you'll do that. But let me give you some idea of why we are involved in this issue, the perspective which we bring to it, and what we hope to achieve by it. As Bill said, the Interfaith Alliance is an organization that works on civil dialogue. We focus on the intersection between religion, politics, and government, and we look at that intersection through the lens of religious freedom. It is a part of our mission to be sure that in what is now the most religiously diverse nation in the world, all of the religions in this nation have a place at the table, a voice at the microphone, because out of this diversity, we can be better informed and a more cooperative nation. So why are we involved in this issue of same-gender marriage? I think all of us would agree that one of the traits of our nation at this moment is things are awfully loud. We have come close in government to losing civil dialogue, which is the art of politics, and which is the oil that makes the government of our nation and its machinery work. And if we do not recover the ability to carry on civil conversations with each other, the impact of that is more expansive than most of us could even imagine. It is time that our politicians rise above their partisanship and become patriotic politicians who are eager not so much to condemn each other as to find ways to cooperate with each other. And that has to come through civil dialogue. I would like to tell you that the religious communities in this nation set a good model for government leaders to follow, but that would not be the case. I think the only politics that I have found to be dirtier than those in Washington are those in religion. because we all use the God language, and God's always on our side. And so when conversations take place between us, it's not just I have an opinion and you have an opinion, let's share them and see where we find common ground. It's I'm right, you're wrong, I don't have to listen to you until you change. And we get nowhere with that. And the rhetoric escalates in volume and insanity. Now, how can we lower the noise? How can we come to some quiet conversations? We have to do that in order to stabilize the foundations that are shaking both in religion and in government in our nation. And I think that that has to start, though this is not all I'm going to talk about today, I think that has to start with us addressing the proper relationship between religion and government. Is the government of the United States under obligation to legislate sectarian morality, the morality of whatever is the pervasive religion in the nation, or the morality of the religious institution that gets into the streets the most people, shouts the loudest message, and has the most influence? The answer to that is no. The founders of our nation had a brilliant concept to affirm religious diversity and to keep religion and government safely independent from each other so that government would have vitality and religion would have integrity. Y'all are good. You get the subtlety. So we have to deal with this issue of how religion and government relate to each other. And I don't think I have to tell you that at stake here is nothing less than whether we have a constitutional form of government or not. And as some people are saying, which I find to be very frightening right now, that is in jeopardy, and in jeopardy also is our government's ability to govern at all because of the high levels of disrespect that you hear in public today. Well, nowhere is this problem more apparent than in addressing the issue of same-gender marriage and its relationship both to religion and to the Constitution. The issue has been discussed loudly. It has been discussed meanly. And it has been discussed primarily with very little productivity. Now, the Interfaith Alliance comes to this issue for two reasons. We think we have some perspective that is responsible regarding the relationship between religion and government, and that perspective has something to say about the way the nation discusses and ultimately rules, legislatively or judicially, on the issue of same-gender marriage. We are an organization that promotes religious liberty. We are for justice. We are for faith, not antithetical to faith. And we are in this conversation not in spite of our faith, but because of our faith. Secondly, is personal. As the president of the Interfaith Alliance, I bring a religious history in my own right. I grew up in the Southern Baptist Convention before it went crazy. That's where I learned about religious freedom and its importance, and that justice is a religious virtue and not just a political virtue, and that hate is neither a political nor a religious virtue. In that convention, conservative even then, but open to new ideas, I saw a blind spot related to sexuality generally, but to homosexuality specifically. I know from my pastoral work, as well as from my work at the Interfaith Alliance, that there are literally thousands of people with religious integrity, with religious sincerity, who have been hurt incredibly by their congregations because everything about their spirituality has been overlooked because of their sexual orientation. That is wrong, and it has to be changed. So that's why we are in this discussion. Let me suggest to you a part of a strategy for dealing with discussions on same-gender marriage. And they will serve us well because we are at another of those moments, given the court ruling this week. We're at another one of those moments when the conversations are going to escalate and hyperbole is going to be a real temptation and emotions will come close to trying to override reason. So let me suggest some points of a strategy for dealing with this to keep it a reasonable and quiet conversation. For goodness sakes, don't start the discussion with religion. I'm dead serious. Don't start the discussion with religion. If you start it there, it will end there. That is not to bypass religion. I'll talk about it in a second. It's not to bypass religion. But it is to start where this discussion belongs. I don't want the federal government deciding what's important about my religion or your religion or in the life of a person who has no religion. It's none of their business. So let's start with where the government ought to have a role, and that's about legality. That's about the Constitution. I don't know. You challenge me on this in the discussion question if you can, because I'd welcome someone that has a good challenge to it. I don't know of a single social issue in our nation around which you can get consensus in religion. Think about it. Not on personal morality, not on social morality, everywhere there are differences. Well, if there are differences on the easy issues, the difficult issues are going to be even more difficult. So don't begin with religion. Marriage is a legal issue in the United States. It is a legal issue. Religions care about it, yes. But you can't get married because of your religion. Officially, you can't. The only way you can get married is to go to a government office, get a license, and assure that the person performing the marriage is working as a representative of the government, not of their religion, of the government. So when someone is talking about official marriage, they're talking not about the position of the Southern Baptist Convention or the Mormon Church or the Catholic Church. They're talking about legality. Who performs the ceremony, and is there a license allowing the ceremony to be performed? So the question or questions related to same-gender marriage are not religious questions, they're legal questions. And whether or not one supports or opposes same-gender marriage is not a matter of whether you are a good Christian, a good Mormon, a good Muslim, a good Hindu. It's a question of whether or not you're a good American. Do you support the Constitution? Two concerns dominate. Government, in defining marriage as presently it is doing, is tampering with an issue it knows little about, and that is marriage from a religious perspective. I don't have to tell you, there are many religious perspectives on marriage, but at the end of the day, the United States government has a responsibility not to be faithful to any religion's tradition on marriage, but to be faithful to the constitutional provision of rights to marriage for everybody, regardless of what a particular religion says about it. The government of this nation should not be in the business of creating second-class citizens in any way, for any civil rights reason. I know that the Mormon Church has a high view of marriage. I've read the documents about it. I know that the Mormon Church has worked hard to promote its particular view of marriage, and that is in order. Roman Catholic Church has done the same thing. The evangelical churches have done the same thing. The Free Church tradition has done the same thing. Other religions have done the same thing. That is the way it should be. But every religion has its own unique perspective about this matter, and that should not be the focus of the government in making its decision about what to do with granting equal rights about civil marriages at all, whether they are heterosexual or homosexual marriages. We have to be run by a constitution that guarantees civil rights to all of its people, regardless of their religion or their lack of religion. That was the purpose of the religious liberty clauses in the Constitution, so that there would be that independence. I was impressed among various statements that came out this past week after the historic ruling, because they were very insightful into kind of not just the substance but the spirit of various religious traditions in this issue. One of my staff members is here with me, Ari Geller, who's our director of communications, and we were talking last night about the Orthodox Jewish declaration statement after the ruling. And though there was disagreement with the ruling, there was an acknowledgement in their statement that they didn't want to try to impose their sectarian morality on the nation through the legislative process. That's the point, really. I mean, every religion ought to be advocating its point of view on moral issues of all kinds. And goodness knows, I have no interest in trying to prohibit that. In fact, I'll go to the mat defending the rights of others to advocate a point of view that I don't particularly happen to agree with. But that is the model, that the religious organizations do their work and the government does its work. Now, you're going to find it, I think, maybe a little interesting when I point out that I think the model from which we can learn the most on this issue is how the government treats divorce. It's ironic, but it's true. Look at how the government treats divorce. It doesn't care what religious organizations say about divorce. I mean, in my tradition, in the Baptist tradition, there are people who condemn divorce, will have no part of divorce, and pastors who will not perform marriages for people who have been divorced. In the Roman Catholic Church, marriage is a sacrament, and that sacrament is for a lifetime, and so there is no possibility of divorce. Is that what the government's doing with divorce? Of course not. It's saying that the government has a legal perspective on marriage and divorce that is independent of any one religion's perspective on that. And so it grants divorces where citizens have good reasons for it to grant divorces, and it leaves it up to various religious traditions to take whatever action they want to take in relation to the divorced people. So if someone is divorced and wants to get remarried, they go to a religious house of worship that will do remarriage for a divorced person. That's the model, friends. That the government's responsibility is to say, all of you are citizens, you are not second class because of your sexual orientation. They ought not have to know anything about your sexual orientation. So if you're a citizen, you have the right of every other citizen in the nation. And if your church doesn't like it, they don't have to. They can condemn you if they want to. They can refuse to perform a ceremony for you if you want to. That is their prerogative. That is the grant of religious freedom in the Constitution that we appreciate and defend. But if the government gives you the license, as they should, so you can get married just like any other citizen, and you find a house of worship that wants to bless that relationship and call it marriage, the government has no right to tell that house of worship, you can't do that. That's the point. So, clearly, this is a civil rights issue. And I think of the many good insights that come out of the court's opinion from this past week is the realization that democracy is functioning at its best when the government can extend rights to people who have been without them without violating the rights of those who already have them. It is a win-win. If you start with religion, there are going to be winners and losers. If you start with the Constitution, everybody wins. The Mormon Church, regardless of how many millions of dollars it invested in the Prop 8 debate, the Mormon Church today, after that court ruling in California, still has the same right to denounce gay marriage, to denounce homosexuality, to take whatever position it wants on that. It has not been silenced. It has not been reprimanded. It will still be respected for holding its view, even if we disagree with it. But it can't impose through government's law its sectarian position. It can condemn, but it can't stop. the rights of citizens who are homosexuals and want to be in same-gender relationships. That is a legal issue. Conversation is possible, even between those of us who seriously disagree with each other. It takes some discipline. It takes biting your lips sometimes. I think you might find it interesting to know that when we started this campaign and produced a green paper around it on religious freedom and same-gender marriage, we launched this at the National Press Club in Washington with me standing between, actually sitting between, Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council and Maggie Gallagher of the National Organization for Marriage. Now, that's not just your typical meeting in Washington. We each spoke our views. We tried not to interrupt each other. We tried to understand each other. And I have to say to you that I was pleasantly surprised that at the end of that discussion, Maggie Gallagher turned to me and said, "You know, I certainly can see a good case here for civil marriage." Now, I have said that in some places, and some places have said, "Oh, big deal. Civil marriage, I understand that. I mean, so what?" But look, that is a quantum leap from a woman telling you that all she knows about you is you're going to hell because you're homosexual. A quantum leap. Is it enough? No, it is not enough. When we started this project, I wanted to write the paper myself. And I struggled with that issue because at one point I thought civil unions looked like a real option. But I listened carefully to my friends and loved ones who are gays and lesbians. And I realized if you go that route, it's still going to be a second-class thing. That's not going to work. We've got to use the same word for these relationships we use for heterosexual relationships, or someone's going to see it as an inferior gift. I know that. I'm willing to work for that. I want to work for that. But my point is that even where it looks like there is no possible bridge of conversation, some can happen if we're quiet enough that we can hear each other and we stay with it long enough to try to reason the thing out together. Are there people unreasonable? Absolutely. I know them. I know them by name. And I don't spend a lot of time trying to talk to them. But there are people who want to be fair, and there are people who want to see justice done. And we're seeing, I know you know these statistics, we're seeing, even in the evangelical community, we're seeing a dramatic rise in the numbers of people who support same-gender marriage. And particularly, if you're talking about the under 30 crowd, you're talking about people who are asking the question, why are you even talking about this? So, it's not over. There's a long way to go. The decision this week is a very important step on a journey that all of us are on. I find my euphoria tempered a little bit by looking at a picture of the Supreme Court justices and knowing the kinds of decisions they've made on some other religious freedom issues and how broad or narrow their sense of justice may be. But you're doing, and I can't, I'm not just saying this, I wish I can say it to every one of you. I know that it is difficult for some of you to stay in your church. it was difficult for me to stay in my church. I admire you for doing that. I also would understand if you didn't. But as long as there is a core constituency, like those who come to this meeting every year and to the actions that this organization sponsors, as long as that's happening, it ain't over. There are some hopeful signs. And I want to be one who came here to encourage you in what you're doing, to help you with a strategy that I think can make a difference for good in the conversations, with hopes that one day we can come back together and we'll have the full deal. I think it could happen. I want to hear from you. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gaddy. This is really a highlight of something for me this year. When I was at Methodist Seminary in the early 60s, two things about the Baptists that struck me. One was, when we studied church and state, the Baptists among the Protestants were the strongest supporters of separation of church and state. And when the Bible decision of the court came down in 1962, it was the Baptists who were the strongest supporters of this decision that's been so condemned by many religious people. And secondly, Reverend Gaddy, would I be sacrificing my rich reputation for humility and my, would this be a sin of pride if I mentioned that my home state of Iowa is where the Supreme Court ruled unanimously a year ago for the same
time?
That's okay. Okay, yeah, good. Exactly. Thank you. I wanted absolution.
Yeah, and let me just tag that by saying that the ruling in Iowa, if you go to that ruling and look up the section on religion, it is an incredibly great statement for you to read in preparation further for these discussions, and it touches on virtually everything that that I have touched on here. I've been in Iowa twice for these kinds of discussions, and people seem to be amazed that happened in Iowa. The fact is, people in Iowa happen to believe the Constitution. and that's what makes the difference. So I remember, I used to live in Georgia, and one time when Lester Maddox was the governor, someone asked Julian Bond if he was a liberal or a conservative. And he said, well, a liberal to Lester Maddox means someone who believes the Constitution, so I guess I'm a liberal. He is a conservative. I'm not quite sure what all he believes. And I've often had that sense here. But that's about the Constitution. It's not about religion.
Okay, come to the mic, and if somebody's already at the mic, just stand behind, get in line, because don't wait, because my time might run out on you.
Thank you. I certainly agree, and I'm encouraged by your outreach and your careful thinking. I'd like you to comment on two things. One is what many of us, or I perceive, maybe you can put another perspective on the politicizing, the deification or politicizing conservative stance within the evangelical and the alignment with one political party, or at least it perceives that way to me. And secondly, I was again discouraged to hear the arguments after the ruling about, God will remove God's blessings if you do this immorally. Mm-hmm. So those two things, if you could comment.
Okay.
And thank you again for your work.
You're welcome. As to the politicization, and I don't want to do this too long, but I've got to give you one bit of background. My doctorate is in social ethics, and I spent 7 years in what was then called the Christian Life Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, which was a great social ethics agency. Our major challenge then was to say to evangelicals that you have a political responsibility, because the standard doctrine was church and politics should never mix. We felt we had to counter that because the religious community does have something to contribute to the national debate on these issues, because there's rarely a political issue that's not a moral issue. Never did we envision a political bloc of pastors trying to tell congregants how they must vote in order to be good evangelicals and so forth. I think it was done. I'm always big on strategy. I saw this from the inside out, so I'm telling you what I know personally. There was a small group of political operatives who decided that mobilization of the evangelical Christian community would be a great way to advance their party. And their party was more aligned with evangelicalism than it was the rest of the nation. Howard Phillips, a strategist for the Republican Party, wrote the strategy for the South and for the evangelicals. He's since repented of that. But there was the genuine belief that if this community was mobilized, it could change the direction of the nation and make some things bad right. And so there were manipulative operatives at the top, but in the movement itself were a lot of genuinely good people who just wanted a better nation. And when they asked the question, how do we get a better nation, the operatives would say, look, you're probably not smart enough to do that. Just listen to us. We'll tell you who to vote for. We'll tell you what offices to run to. So I think there was a mixed motivation among the people, a singular motivation of power and economics at the top, and the top manipulated the people to do what's happening. What was your second question? It was.
I had to do with.
Right. Okay. I'm a big confessional. I am more and more these days drawn to that apathetic theology just doesn't use the name God, because most of the references I hear to God today are so out of touch with my belief in God that it doesn't fit. The image that remains in my mind is watching CNN on the night that the Ninth District ruled on the Pledge of Allegiance and outlawed again the one nation under God, the under God part. The justification for that by Jeffrey Toobin, who is the legal analyst for CNN, said this will not go anywhere because God is not listen to this. God is not a religious word in this nation. God is now a word of patriotism. Now, I find great offense at that. And the reason that I am so reticent for anybody in politics to use God as their mascot is because my belief in God is at the core of my belief about life itself, and it is far too sacred to be drawn through polling places and political stump speeches. So I resent it.
Yes, Reverend, I'd like to thank you personally for traveling to Salt Lake City to be here with us today.
Glad to do it.
It's been a pleasure listening to you, and you're an outstanding speaker.
Thank you.
My question is, are you able to speak as clearly on this subject to us as you did to us today with your congregation back in Louisiana?
It's a great question.
And if not, how do you deal with the practical problems of that?
That's a really great question. I made a decision when I, and you know, almost every question has a history behind it, and I'll be again brief. I resigned my role as pastor in that congregation when I took the job in Washington. And only about 9 months later did they come back and ask me if I would take the pastorate again and give them as much time as I could from this national job. I made a decision at that point that I would never say in one venue what I could not say in another venue. That I would never say in Monroe something I couldn't justify in Washington. I would never say in Washington something I couldn't justify there. So I resolved that then. I've tried to abide by that. It is otherwise a very schizophrenic life that I just don't want to live. I don't know how much you know about Monroe, Louisiana. It is not a hotbed of liberalism. we've had our yard trashed some, and one of my favorite stories is I was standing out in front of the cafeteria talking to a member of the city council, and he kept doing this, and finally he said, "Listen, I've talked to you as long as I just can't be seen talking to you very long." So there are downsides to it, but then it keeps you from talking to a lot of people you don't want to talk to anyway. So it's one and the same. The message is one and the same, and you take your lumps both places, and you know, you've just got to be, and I don't have, you all know this, it's got to be from the inside out, not from the outside in. Because when you're doing any kind of work that advances justice and rights, people are going to be opposed to it. And, you know, we hear the common stuff that we're working for Satan and that we're trying to undermine the United States government and all of that. And when you said thank you for coming to Salt Lake City, you know, one of the reasons that I come to Salt Lake City is because I think I have something to share with you that you may can use. But the other part of it is I like to be with some people who think what we're doing is important. It's good for us. Yes, sir.
My question is about in how to approach conversations with other people. In the conversations that I've had specifically with other Mormons, I've always approached it from a legal standpoint and trying to show that extending rights to one group of people will never infringe on, specifically in the case of same-gender marriage, will never infringe on your personal rights of to marry who you want or even your religious freedom. But they always counter with, well, it will in the future. It'll infringe on our religious rights and religious freedom. And so my question is, how do you respond to something like that where it's almost like they're playing on just a level of uncertainty of the future that if we do this, the slippery slope fallacy will lead to this. Yeah. And it's really hard to counter with something that they will be able to assimilate and understand. So.
Well, I think obviously it's a dodge. And I think that one response to that is saying it won't change if you'll join me in supporting fidelity to the Constitution, because I'm as willing to protect your right and the right of this church to do what it wants as I am willing to work for what I believe is right in terms of justice. Ultimately, I mean, the beauty of that argument that they've given you is you can't prove it. You know, and I think the slippery slope, and I'm being a little bit facetious here, but I think the slippery slope is that, my goodness, we might end up being sure that all people have rights.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for coming to speak to us. I enjoy your remarks, and I have two questions, but they're somewhat more challenging because I feel like no one else maybe will ask you here somewhat more difficult questions.
Fine, come on.
And so even though I agree with most of your remarks, I still want to ask them.
Good.
The first thing is that a second ago again reiterated that you think there's no rights issues involved for people that are religious when gay marriage passes. And I think that that's at least a simplistic way of looking at things. There have been cases of people that have lost their jobs or gotten into serious professional trouble because of their views on same-sex marriage or same-sexuality. For instance, the photographer who was fined for not photographing a gay marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Or the pavilion that was sued and lost a lot of their tax-free status because they wouldn't have a gay marriage in their pavilion, which they opened to other couples that belong to a church.
Right.
There have been real cases where people have gotten in trouble for their expression of their rights. And so I think that I want to hear how you address that and whether how you take a stance on those issues.
Okay.
The second question that I have is, you talk a lot about dialogue and interacting with those that feel different than we do. But it seems to me that the rhetoric even you've used here has already been divisive, dividing people that don't agree with you into people that don't defend the Constitution or don't support rights.
Mm-hmm.
That seems counterproductive to the goals you're talking about. There is a consensus on civil unions, generally, even among many Mormons, and there's consensus among certain rights being included. So my question is, if you're serious about dialogue, why don't we begin there with building common ground, rather than pushing for the most extreme option through the courts, whether it's right or wrong?
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't seem like a very good way to build dialogue, which is the goal of yours.
Right. Okay, I'll try to respond briefly to those two questions. Let me take your first question and say that the work of the Interfaith Alliance is not limited to what we're doing on same-gender marriage, on what we're doing here in the paper and the work around it. We were very active in organizing the religious community against the proposed amendment to the Constitution that came up during the Bush administration to define marriage as between one man and one woman. But we're also very active right now in trying to get Workplace Religious Freedom Act reintroduced into Congress so that we can work on that, which is for all people. And we are very much involved in trying to bring corrections to the faith-based office in the White House to stop the sectarian organizations getting direct funding from the government, which then makes them an instrument of the government and causes all kinds of havoc. So what we're talking about this morning is one slice of a real large pie. Now, you are right that there are people whose rights seem to have been violated, but they haven't been violated because the rights don't exist. They have been violated because of people who ignore rights to impose their views, their will on individuals as means of punishment for those people doing things that they don't want them to do. And in a nation of law, you don't need to go to a seminar on that. You need to enforce the law. And that's what we're calling for. So when we say that giving one group of people rights will not violate other people's rights, I mean, that's very true. Does that mean that when these people exercise their rights, they may not be criticized, they may not have their yards junked, they may not have someone dismiss them as a photographer at a wedding, or in the case of the faith-based office, that they may get turned away because they're gay and that particular office in Atlanta will not service them for that? Yeah, those things are going to happen. But you correct those not with a pep talk, but with enforcing the law. So, I mean, that's where we are on that one. On the second one, I think Tell me what bothers you most about in your second question, and let me just respond to the core, because we've got a lot of other people. What's the bottom line?
Well, the bottom line for me is that it seems if you want to actually have dialogue, people disagree, you go for what's the consensus.
I see. Okay.
Go
okay. For me, and I don't mean to be unkind about this. I'm being very honest about this. I don't think you can have just a little bit of freedom, even as you can't be just a little bit pregnant. You either have freedom or you don't. And I know far too many people. In fact, I can prove it by polling numbers. If you do a poll and ask a general public, do you believe in religious freedom? You'll get 75% of the people saying yes. If you ask them that question later in the poll, do you believe in church-state separation, which they relate then to this issue, you'll get about 40% saying yes. So the generalities are easy. But these are the issues where the principle gets tested most. And so I can talk with Tony Perkins and Maggie Gallagher all day about, well, can we just agree that we love each other? We can. But how we love each other and how that gets translated politically is difficult, and we've got to address those difficulties. Yes, ma'am.
Probably nobody else stands, and four questions quite well.
Okay.
Somebody said this might not be okay. I'll shout.
Stand close to it anyway.
I work for an organization called Mormons for Marriage, and we've been having discussions like this for a couple of years. And in October in San Francisco, we're going to be doing a workshop about furthering conversational dialogue. I'm wondering if the Interfaith Alliance, where we can find a green paper, where we can find resources similar to what you've proposed here, that we could.
We have. I hate to say this. We have about 25 copies of the green paper, but and you're welcome. We certainly want you to get one to see it. Ari will hand them out as long as we have them, but it is on our website. And the website is on there. It's on our website. And we are also going to produce a second edition of it to account for some of the things that have taken place. So yes, we'll be glad to supply you materials. If you want us and the time is available to come there and be supportive of you, we will do that. We'll be glad to work with you. I thought your statement on the ruling was excellent. Yeah. Yes.
Now, I've got the email address if anybody misses Dr. Gaddy.
Okay.
I'm a lawyer, and I'm one of the choir who were preaching. I've written about the issues involving church and state and why same-sex marriage or Prop 8 in California is not the worst, or illegally, that people claimed it was. The most recent, I think, statement by a church authority about the Perry versus Schwarzenegger case was that, in effect, if the plaintiffs won in that case, the government would be telling you you could not vote your religious conscience, which I thought was absurd. You can go out tomorrow, and if your religious conscience said that we will behead all gay people, you can put something on the ballot and vote on it. But the Supreme Court would, of course, have the right to claim that that isn't legal. It isn't constitutional. I have a question, but I did want to make...
No, that's fine. I'm glad to hear you say that.
To the comment that was just recently made here, I have specific knowledge about these cases in New Jersey and in the photographer case. And in neither of those states did they involve gay marriage in the least. Both of those states did not accept gay marriages. They were civil rights issues. And Proposition 8 had nothing to do with civil rights issues. In fact, in the case in New Jersey, the church was not required to marry or allow a gay couple to use their facility. They were told that if they didn't, because the law specifically said if you open your facility to the public, you can take advantage of a tax break. And if you're not going to open it to the public, you can't take advantage of the tax bill. That has nothing to do with gay marriage. And the photographer case, likewise, in that state, gay marriage was not legal. It was just a photograph, a civil union type situation. And the law was that you couldn't discriminate. And that law, that horse has already left the barn. I mean, you're not going to change that. And fighting against gay marriage has nothing to do with that. Now, my question, though, is this. I've read the decision by the judge, which I thought was extremely well written and well reasoned. As I read it, and he remarked on the importance of gay marriage, or of marriage in general, the marriage is a fundamental civil right, it made me think, why cannot that same argument be made regarding polygamous marriages? And I'm sure that if it gets up to the Supreme Court, that Justice Scalia is going to point that out. I'm just curious about what you feel about polygamous marriages. Would you be supportive of those also being legalized?
I would not. The reasoning on it is different. I could even be charged with being inconsistent, but to be very honest with you, I have not studied that the way I have studied this. I do know that that is an argument that is often used in countering the kinds of things that I have said today. And frankly, I'm not ready to outline what my arguments are on that. I really, and you're right, we may not have the luxury of doing that, but I personally would like to see us focus on the same gender issue, and then if we need to move to the polygamous proposal, do that. But I think this one has all of the ingredients, not only of a justice issue in itself, but of the whole issue of the relationship between religion and government that needs to be resolved before we go any further with the marriage question.
Yeah,
yes, sir.
Last question.
Thank you for your remarks. I have the privilege of observing the American society from abroad, France, not to say it, and to relate and compare. And for most of what you've said, I had the impression of hearing Thomas Jefferson when he called for a wall of separation between the church and state.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, the United States has had that principle in its constitution much longer before France,
mm-hmm.
and yet I have the impression that this wall of separation is not there. And I was wondering whether you've mentioned the plurality, religious plurality, which is good, but at the same time I was wondering whether anyone has considered that the Constitution, the First Amendment, I know it is sacred, but
mm-hmm.
yet has anyone considered whether it is itself problematic in that you can use it as a Bible? What I mean is that
mm-hmm.
any church, you've talked about consensus, how it's difficult to reach a consensus. Even the Mormon church can use the Bible to justify its claims.
Sure.
Any church use it to justify their claims. And I'm working on Proposition 8 and how the Mormon church and other churches have been lacking it. And it seems to me that just like people are calling for individual rights described in the Constitution,
yeah.
the Constitution is also being used to advance the Mormon church's agenda in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when it says grievances, what is a grievance? From whose perspective is a grievance defined?
Okay, your question deserves a lot longer answer than I can give, respecting the time here. I think the brilliance of the First Amendment is that there are two clauses. There is a no establishment clause and there's a free exercise clause. That gives us some maneuverability and some protection on the very issues that you're talking about. When you say that wall doesn't exist, I think it exists. I think it's pretty battered right now, and it's got some chunks out of it. But I think it's still there. The principle that Jefferson used and Jefferson's colleagues used on the application of the religious liberty principle was that it had to be imposed with reason. Yes, there is absolutely no way to guarantee absolute separation because houses of worship take up residence on public property and benefit from fire departments and all of those. So yes, there is some confusion there. But the genius and what's I think the good evidence of the genius of it is that in a nation that is the most religiously pluralistic in the world, we still have, from a global perspective, the best kinds of relationships between religions in this nation, I suppose, that you could expect. We have been spared the violent kind of conflict between religions that we've seen in other places. No establishment of religion means that there will be no official church in this nation, that the state will not wed itself, I didn't mean to use that word, will not wed itself to a particular religion, and that rights in this nation will not depend on whether or not a person is religious. That's no establishment clause there. But there's a free exercise clause. And the free exercise clause says you can exercise your religion with all the freedom and passion you wish up to the point that the exercise of your freedom compromises someone else's freedom. And those are two principles that have served us well. I'm glad we have them. Thank you for your hearing and your conversation.
Thanks, Dr. Gaddy. And a reminder that Ari's got the pamphlet over here. I'll just make one comment. You know, in our church, we had listening circles where we spoke to each other with the rules being no debate. And we always came away feeling better about the people on the other side.
Right.
So it worked really well. Yeah.